Chapter 12. Aftermath Examined. The cobblestones were blackened, even melted in places. The charred remains of buildings stood out about the edges of the devastation, but toward the middle, only buildings with stone foundations showed any signs of having existed at all. There were signs of recovery, though, for the residents of that particularly downtrodden neighborhood of Marker's Point. A few ramshackle buildings had been put up, while real work was being done to replace others. "How far across would you say it is, one side to the other?" Soria asked, her eyes sweeping the scene. She wore her Keshi persona. In a place like Marker's Point, looking as if you invited trouble was paradoxically the best way to avoid meeting it. It also saved her the trouble of either hiding or drawing strange looks for her Keshi accent.
100 paces across, I'd say, Tanner offered. Maybe 150.
Closer to 200, I think, Rakashi ventured. You have a long stride, my friend.
Well, I'm not measuring with yours. What sort of fool counts using his guess as someone else's stride?
So black powder or ether? Soria asked. She nodded in the direction of the helm that Zell was carrying. Zell donned the helm and looked about the burned streets. Ether, Zell stated. They had concealed the stolen crown inside the helm, wrapping it in cloth and sewing it into the leather liner that cushioned the wearer's head. It looks scratched up. I don't know how else to describe it, but it stands out for certain.
So, what then? Tanner asked. We have a warlock running around here incinerating buildings. I don't think I care to meet him. If he knows his stuff, what would he want with a bunch like us? We'd be small timers to him. If he can't control his ether and this is what happens.
He gestured to their general vicinity.
I don't know that it would be safe traveling with him.
I think Tanner's right, Soria, Zelasan added, taking the magical helm off and nodding. This one is too dangerous. We do well enough for ourselves that I don't see the risk being worth it. Really? Soria asked sardonically. You are both turning squirrel on me now that we are getting close to our quarry. Some warriors you two are. How about you, Rakashi?
I think it is time you told us who we are following. You know something, I think, that we do not,
the clever Rakashi answered. Soria eyed him steadily, watching for a sign that he would relent, but he met her glare stoically. Fine, she replied, but not out here in the open.
So if Rakashi's right, you have some reason to think this Kairos fellow will join us,
Zelasan postulated, taking a swallow of the thick dark ale. They had picked out an upper-class tavern for their discussion, the Ale Exchange. It served mainly ship owners, financiers, traveling noblemen, and the assorted retainers such men brought with them. It also attracted coin blades of various ilk, so their weapons were not entirely out of place. Speak Kadrin while we are here, just in case, Soria instructed in Kadrin. If anyone looks like they are paying attention to what we say, we will have to kill or capture them.
He is that important, this person we are looking for? Rakashi asked, speaking in Kadrin with a Tikalish accent.
It was not his native tongue, but he spoke it well. Yes, and used no names. A garbled conversation with a proper name mixed in stands out, if the name is the only familiar word, Soria said.
Now you're just being paranoid. Anyone who knows the name must be able to understand the rest, wouldn't you think?
Tanner objected.
He was waiting on the steward to bring up a bottle of Tikalish apple liqueur that Rakashi had suggested.
Watching Zelasan and Soria already enjoying their ales was making him impatient and irritated. Fine then, Soria relented. I do know who this Kairos Hinterdale is, or at least quite strongly suspect. I got the clue I needed at Rainsdark when...
Skip it. Tell the story later. Just give us a name, Tanner cut in, looking around distractedly for the steward.
You have no sense of drama, Soria complained. When I was at Rainsdark, she picked up, ignoring Tanner's complaint. I saw the Magrin sorcerer who stole the staff of Galen. He did not recognize me, but he knew Brannis by sight. Brannis knew him as well, addressing him as Captain Zane.
Wait, so that pirate is a twin-born Magrin sorcerer? Zelisan asked. Small wonder he has been so successful.
Yes, those were cannons he used at Rainsdark. He taught the goblins how to make ones like those a ship would carry. I saw a few of them before the warlock had them melted down, Soria said.
I see, Rikashi stated, having surely already skipped ahead to her conclusion.
Yes, well, this sorcerer knew Brannis as well, and he called him Kyrus.
Soria finished her little tale, and Tanner and Zell gaped at her.
No wonder you're so hot to find him, Zelisan joked. I had wondered if you would follow through on the whole wedding arrangement, and now I see why you did. You were just going to find yourself a new Brannis.
Ha ha, Tanner said. I've been wanting a chance to cross swords with this new Grand Marshal of ours. Can't exactly march up to him in Cadrus and ask for a sparring match, though.
Mind you, he is still the same man we have been tracking. He is a scribe in Tellurak, not a knight. And I do not think he has known that he is twin-born for very long at all. 4 months ago, it seems, he was playing with light and telekinesis spells. 3 months ago, he needed help to free himself from a non-ether-proof prison cell, but managed to burn a ship down in the harbor. A week after that, he destroyed a chunk of Marker's Point. On the road to Rainsdark, Brannis had brought along books of magic. Oh, he said they were to figure out how to best use the sorcerers he was assigned. But Brannis is too clever by half. He was teaching this Kyrus some proper spells, so he would not have another incident like Marker's Point.
How can you be so sure of all that? Zell seemed more curious than skeptical. Knowing Soria to be rash and reckless, yes, but she was far from stupid.
I know him too well. Most of us had some help in figuring out how being twin-born worked, and all of us were much younger than 22 when we first learned our dreams weren't dreams. Brannis seems to have puzzled out much of it on his own, or gleaned it from Captain Zane. But availability of the libraries in the Tower of Contemplation is too valuable to pass up. As Sixth Circle, even I was not allowed in most of those. But because Brannis seems to have found favor with the warlock, he has free run of the place, Soria said. If you discovered magic in Tellurak and knew of no one in Vaedras whom you could trust with the Twinborn secret, how much better could you have it than being able to access every book in Cadrus at your leisure?
Yeah, but if that was him with Zane, and Zane is Magrin on the other side, how do we know we can trust either of them? Tanner asked. Maybe he plays both sides. You say he's so clever. Maybe he has you fooled, too.
Soria frowned, crossed her arms, and leaned back in her chair. I bet my life that he will not side against me. Rikashi appeared to be about to say something, then paused, distracted. He sat with his back to the door, but with his patched eye he saw in the ether. Direction mattered little.
You said that pirate's name too many times, I think. Someone just left furtively. I think our pirate quarry has ears with coins in them.
Zelisan swore under his breath. Soria threw a backhanded slap that jarred Tanner's shoulder. Paranoid, huh?
I lost track of him in the crowds outside. There are too many people here, and he was not so distinctive, Rikashi said. What now? Tanner asked.
Nothing, Soria replied. At least, nothing we were not about to do anyway. We know the pirate sailed months ago, and his ship has not returned. Safe to say, we will not meet him in person. Whatever lackeys he paid to inform on troublemakers dropping his name in public will pose little threat.
Yeah, but who will they be telling about us? Zelisan asked. The pirate might have the kind of coin that could buy a few of the tide's watchmen. That might get us stranded here.
Deal with the problems we know about, Soria said. We aren't the sort to get pushed around, after all. If our little parrot talks to someone and gets the pirate's hired knives to come looking for us, at least it will be a lead. In the meantime,
We ought to split up and spend a lot of coin with the sort of folk a pirate might deal with. They may not take open bribes for information on someone as dangerous as the pirate, but we might loosen tongues if we buy their wares first.
Anything in mind? Zelisan asked. I don't go to market with pirates much. What would they buy that a common man wouldn't?
How should I know?
Be creative, Soria responded.
Zel just rolled his eyes. Nice to know we're in good hands, eh?
Zelisan leaned over to Tanner and spoke loudly enough to ensure Soria still heard.
Well, you two will go together, she told the mock conspirators, and Rakashi will come with me.
Why do I get saddled with the big oaf? Tanner complained. If we have to run, I'll have to hold up and wait for him. And that means a lot more sword work.
Well, with how well that helm shows the ether, Zell ought to be able to walk around with it on and not trip all over stuff you and I cannot see without light.
Rakashi can see both at once, so both pairs can keep an eye to the ether, Soria reasoned.
What good'll that do us? Tanner asked. We aren't looking for a bit of magic. We're looking for a person, if he's even in the point anymore. How would you expect to pick him out when every market has 1,000 folk in it?
Tanner, your source split to the Tellurak side. Mine split fairly evenly with Juliana's, maybe a bit in her favor.
Zell's a dim candle in both worlds, and Rakashi is much stronger in Vaedris. Brannis's source is like the glow of a firefly. If this Kyrus is running around laying waste to whole city districts, you can bet that his source will stand out like an ogre walking among the common folk around here.
Makes sense, Zelisand said, though he was a bit sensitive about the subject of his weak source and preferred not to discuss it.
And unless he looks a lot less like Brannis than you would expect, I ought to recognize him if I take the helm off.
He ought to know my face too, just seeing it, recently.
Zell trailed off, not wanting to remind Soria about Juliana's wedding and the little incident afterward. Soria shot him a glare, but made no comment on the slip.
We will meet back at the ship an hour before sunset. If there is any night work to be done, I would rather plan it anew. We might be best hanging together after dark.
Well, I'll be flogged. She does have a sense of self-preservation, Tanner joked. Only had to take coming to the point and having a pirate's hired ears catch a sniff of her.
No, Soria shot back. I don't trust you after dark because there are more brothels here than inns. If I ever have to identify your dead body, I would rather it be clothed.
Tanner could think of no clever response, so they parted ways in silence. One smug, two amused, and one consternated.
I don't want no trouble, were the first words out of the shipper's mouth as Soria and Rakashi approached.
He was Janza by his look, scraggly gray hair framing a puffy round face, pocked by scars of a pimpled youth long decades ago. He carried a slate in one gnarled hand and held a chalk in the other. While all about men bustled with barrows filled with sacks of wheat flour or carried kegs of cheap ale, the shipping master merely watched and recorded.
Excellent. Troubles make business go less smoothly, Rakashi replied, smiling broadly at the shipper. I am Rakashi Darfandar, and it is business I am seeking today.
And who's the lass?
The shipper asked suspiciously. Soria still wore her Keshi persona, complete with tattooed kill markings. It was not the sort of sight most folk found comforting.
My bodyguard, Rakashi answered, smiling serenely.
Carrying his half-spear in a sheath on his back and built like a warrior, Rakashi did not look like the sort of man to need a bodyguard. The shipping master eyed Soria warily, but turned his attention back to Rakashi.
What sort of business? I am a busy man. Nothing moves through this warehouse without me knowing about it.
I am looking for a shipment of cinnamon cherry liqueur, Rakashi said. My employer's ship was attacked by pirates, and the spirits were plundered.
I don't deal in pirated goods, the shipper replied testily. If that's all you are concerned with, then I have no business with you.
You misunderstand me.
My employer has a very valuable customer whom he would much like to keep happy. I do not care where I find a replacement, but I must see that his customer receives the goods he has purchased. Even if we lose money this time, we wish to keep the customer's business for many years to come. So if you know of any such liqueur, whether it has come through your warehouse or not, I would be willing to pay generously for such information, Rakashi said. He reached into his coin purse, pulled out 1,000 darshi coin, and handed it to the shipping master. The darshi was a small unit of currency, but 1,000 of them acting in concert could secure the services of the best whores in Marker's Point, or purchase a bottle or two of the aforementioned liqueur.
What's this for?
The man asked, narrowing his eyes and pocketing the coin before any talk of returning it came up.
A pittance for your time, Rakashi answered. Should you know anything about where such cargoes might find themselves, I would be more than generous.
He patted his coin purse, making sure that the heavy leather pouch jingled loudly enough to convey just how much coin he was carrying.
Well, there's a dock that I never have cause to frequent, mind you, where I hear Zane's people have set up their operation. If it was Captain Zane's ship that took your employer's shipment, that might be a place to find it. If not, it might be a good bet to find a replacement.
As they walked away 10,000 darshis poorer, Soria muttered to Rakashi, It's a good thing we have plenty of coin.
We will not for long if we spend like this. But then again, it is only coin, and we may have more whenever we wish. If Kairos Hinterdale truly is your old lover from Kadrin, any impediment to our wealth ought to be gone once we have his aid.
Well, Soria thought, I still have to figure out how to convince Brannis that brigandry and mercenary work are respectable occupations. One problem at a time, though.
What are you thinking, Tanner? Zelisan sounded exasperated as Tanner held the pistol up close to his eye, examining it as if he possessed either a craftsman's eye for workmanship or an artisan's appreciation of fine detail.
I always wanted one, Tanner said. I mean, I'm as good as any fella you want to put against me when it comes to swords, but what good's a sword when some drunk whore son with a pistol can put a lead ball through your gut at 20 paces?
30, I would say, with the one in your hand, the bespectacled pistol-smith corrected him.
Accurately, that is. The shot will go much farther, but accuracy is the byword when it comes to pistols. You do not want to miss your mark and have to clean and load it while some unruly gentleman is rushing to stab you before you can do so.
Maybe I could buy 2 of them then, Tanner reasoned. Have the other ready if and I happen not to hit the fella I was aiming at.
Many do, sir, I assure you, many do. Many dangerous men carry a pistol tucked into their belt. Carrying 2 or more is a sure sign of someone who intends to use one, though. Only a fool would trifle with such a man.
The pistol smith no doubt smelled a sale that would let him close up shop for a week, if only he could draw Tanner a picture of himself as a man who'd commanded fear and respect.
What if you can't hit a ship at 10 paces, let alone a man? Zelisan butted in, needling Tanner, who, to the best of his knowledge, had never fired a pistol in his life.
I realize you jest, sir, but if you mean to ask what does one do if 2 shots are not enough? The pistol smith seemed to know his trade, and the crafting of weapons was only the half of it. The rest was the art of selling them once made.
At some point, only a very large man can keep putting more pistols in his belt.
He paused to allow Tanner a brief chuckle in Zell's direction.
For a more refined marksman, I do have a special piece.
The pistol smith went to the back of his shop and brought back a small, polished mahogany case. Tanner and Zelisan both crowded around to get a good look as the wiry little man opened the case. Inside was a queer-looking pistol, which had a sort of thick wheel stuffed in just above the trigger. It was smaller than the other pistols that the pistol smith had shown them already, with a thinner barrel and shorter handle, though the latter was of sleek, polished ivory.
Fancy handle, but a bit of an ugly runt of a thing, ain't it?
Tanner commented to Zelasan. Yeah, what's that bit there do? Zell asked, pointing a finger at the thick metal wheel at the trigger end of the barrel. This is an authentic piece from Cadmus Errol's workshop, made by the master's own hand. He has made a dozen or so, though now I understand his assistants have begun making more of them. You load this pistol with 6 shots, and each time it fires, it brings a new shot into line with the barrel. The pistol smith pulled a pin, and the wheel twisted out away from the rest of the weapon. With the flick of a thumb, the wheel spun effortlessly with a reassuring whirring sound. With a snap of the wrist, the pistol smith locked the wheel back into place. He pushed and pulled to show that the wheel was once more securely held, then pulled the pin again and showed inside it. It takes a special shot that has a powder charge already attached to it, the little man said, then took a small pointed metal shot out of a different case stowed under the counter. It had a brass band around the non-pointed end and a flat back. I know it looks strange, but it'll hit what you aim at from 50 paces, and you have 6 shots before needing to reload. Impressive, Zelasan said, but he was more impressed by seeing yet another of Cadmus Errol's creations. Soria had told him of the alarm system the Mad Tinker had set up in the museum in Golis, and any folk who had traveled widely had seen one or more of his clock towers. It seemed that the mechanical mastermind was delving into weapons as well.
Ah, I see your angle. You make coins selling shot I gotta buy from you, Tanner hedged, trying to set himself up to negotiate a good price. He wanted that pistol, and if he had to buy his ammunition from Marker's Point, so be it.
Sadly, no. The master has his workshop churning them out like horseshoes. I have crates of the things ready to sell, and I am far from the sole distributor of them.
The smith shook his head.
I suspect in 5 years I will no longer be selling my own pistols anymore, just reselling the ones that Errol's workshop produces. Whatever it is you do for work, sir, pray that Cadmus Errol does not take a fancy to trying it.
An hour later, Tanner was walking at Zelasan's side, a Cadmus Errol pistol tucked in the front of his pants, and a baldric laden with pre-powdered shots slung crosswise across his body. Despite the magical shield he cast each morning and the ruined blade that bounced at his hip, sharp enough to bite into stone, it was the pistol that had cost him 200,000 eccles worth of trade bars, 10 times what one of the ones made by the master's assistants would have lightened his purse by. That made him feel dangerous.
We are being followed, Rakashi said, leaning close to Soria as they walked, keeping his voice low so that they might not be overheard.
How many? She asked. She knew better than to request any more detail than that.
Rakashi was watching behind them in the ether, and his vision was nowhere near keen enough to determine age or garb, or what they carried.
2, Rakashi replied, without turning to look at her. We picked them up just after we left the warehouse.
Do you think that shipper sent them? Soria wondered aloud, turning down a side street to get away from the crowded main thoroughfare, to somewhere she might be able to look back and check out their pursuers.
Stranger things have happened, surely, Rakashi joked, but I think not. I believe we merely stopped there for long enough that whoever was looking for us had time to find us.
Soria saw a stack of crates that had been delivered to a woodworker's shop and ducked behind them. She grabbed Rakashi roughly by the arm and dragged him behind cover as well. She crouched low and shifted her own vision into the ether to watch the two men through the wood of the crates. Luck was with her, and the crates contained nothing with a source of its own. No chickens, fresh lobster, or potted herbs were left blocking the sight lines of the narrow road in the ether. As the two men neared, walking slowly and obviously wary of their vanished prey, Soria allowed her vision to revert to the light as she leapt from her concealment. Rakashi followed her lead, drawing his half-spear fluidly as he took up a position behind her. It was not the most gentlemanly of fighting arrangements, but he had learned through experience that being between Soria and her enemies was hazardous. Soria grabbed the closer of the two by the wrist
pulling and twisting to force him down and off his balance. She fell with him and atop him, rolling across his back to launch a kick at the back of his companion's knees. The blow struck true, and both men were on the ground before they could react to defend themselves. Soria continued her roll until she had regained her feet. One pursuer still held in her wrist lock. Rakashi put the point of his half-spear to the base of the other man's throat.
"Fine day for a walk, good sirs," Soria greeted them sweetly in Keshi.
Given the men's lightly bronzed skin, dark eyes, and dark hair, it was an easy guess as to their homeland, the northern part of Kesh, where the native blood was mixed thickly with foreign. Neither of them had reacted to the fight like a trained warrior, though both carried knives at their belt. It was said that in Marker's Point, even midwives carried a blade, and that reputation was better deserved than most visitors realized. Still, the knife could only do so much from its sheath. The two Keshi snoops bore lazy blades that had never left theirs to defend their owners.
"Please, do not kill me,"
begged the one Rakashi held at spear point.
"We mean no offense."
"You were interested in Denric Zane. Our master, he too is interested in Zane. He would like to meet you and your friends,"
said the man whose arm Soria was wrenching.
"To what end?" Rakashi asked calmly, pulling the half-spear's point away from his captive's throat just a finger's breadth.
"Maybe to hire you."
Soria and Rakashi exchanged a glance. Soria shrugged. Rakashi nodded. It was the best lead they were likely to find.
"My thanks for sparing the lives of my servants. They are both clumsy and unwise,"
Parjek Ranhalmar greeted them that evening at his tiny palace on the seaside of the island chain, facing the sunset. Few could afford to excavate the rocky outer rim of the islands, giving such locales instant prestige among the residents of the point. Parjek bore no noble title, though,
for Kesh was miserly with such hereditary honors,
having fewer noblemen than Acardia, despite 50 times the population of those northern traders.
"They made no move for their weapons. I had the luxury of mercy."
Soria spoke for the group as the four of them stood before the Keshi shipping magnate. She looked curiously about the room as she spoke, admiring the opulent imported marble stonework as it contrasted with traditional Keshi woven straw mats, which were sold in bulk in every market the Keshi traded with.
"Quite so," Parjek agreed disinterestedly,
giving the impression that his interest in his men's lives was feigned out of politeness.
"Now I understand that you have some sort of interest in a pirate named Denric Zane."
He waved a hand dismissively at Soria to forestall the answer she was about to give.
No, I know you do. I have an interest in him as well. I have lost 2 ships to him now. This is most obviously not good for my business. My customers expect their shipments to arrive. Storms may sink a trader's ships and send the cargo to a soaking grave. But what can be done about a storm, eh? You find good captains and hope they are better than the storms they see. Ah, but pirates! My customers do not like hearing that some pirate now has their wares.
So you want us to hunt him down for you? Soria asked, raising an eyebrow. She had really hoped to find out about Brannis's, or Kyrus's, whereabouts through more oblique methods than dealing with Denric Zane directly. Aside from the very real possibility that he would recognize her from their encounter at Rainsdark, he might very well be a threat in her own world.
No, I wish to bait a trap for him. I have another ship setting sail, laden with valuable goods. For the sake of discussion, let us call them mangoes. I am too well known to ship my mangoes in complete secrecy, so word escapes even before the ship leaves port. Pirates love mangoes because they are easy to carry, easy to sell, and quite valuable, Parjek explained.
And when he attacks your ship, we catch him and kill him. That about do it? Tanner quipped.
Soria and Parjek both glared at him. Soria was supposedly their leader, or she had told Parzhek as much at least. It undercut her authority to have her underling interrupt the negotiation of the deal.
That roughly outlines the plan, yes, Parzhek continued. However, I need to know that I pay for good fighters. My coin blades must be able to overpower the boarding party that Zane sends aboard, and then take the fight to his own ship.
You, he said, looking at Soria.
Who take Coinblade as a surname even? I hope to see some evidence that you are worthy of the name. By your dress and manner, you are Tezuan's son trained. I have two Tezuan bodyguards myself.
And at the mention, two formidable-looking men stepped in from a side room. They were both Keshi, with close-cropped yellow hair and muscular bare arms, pure-blooded southerners, exposed by the same design of armor that Soria wore. Neither was as tall as she was, but they were more stocky of build.
Meet Jovin and Darbin. They will be among those on the bait ship with you, should you pass my test, Parzhek said.
What test? Soria asked, narrowing her eyes at the Keshi merchant prince.
It is easy for a Keshi lass to buy armor and call herself a Tezuan son disciple, Parzhek answered, his hands worrying at one another under her glare. You need not win, of course, but you must convince Darbin that you really are Tezuan. No blades, no killing. This is merely to confirm that you are who you claim to be.
Soria fought to keep a smirk off her face.
If only you knew.
Managing to keep her composure, Soria turned to face her would-be opponent. She cracked her knuckles as she let her vision fade into the ether. Though she had not been told which of the two Keshi was to be her opponent, she knew immediately. The one to her right was the stronger of the two by his source, and was the easy choice to test her skills. Drawing from her own source, Soria worked a straightforward telekinesis spell. The one whom she had guessed to be Darbin stood still, dark eyes widening as he tried to adopt a formal Tezuan sparring stance. Soria knew, though, that he now felt as if he had been buried in sand, his limbs held tightly in place. He could wiggle a bit, but was otherwise held fast.
Darbin, step forward and face her, Parzhek ordered impatiently,
when his guard had not made a move after a moment.
What are you waiting for?
Do you yield?
Soria asked him, looking him squarely in the eye. She had always hated being asked that question. The children knelt in orderly rows on the rough stone floor of the courtyard in the Temple of the Sun. They were ordered by age, then by skill, with the eldest students at the front and the strongest of each age toward the middle. Soria knelt in the very center of the 14-year-old disciples, as she had knelt in the center position of the 13-year-olds the year before. The parting of ways had come yet again, along with another chance at freedom. She kept silent, unmoving, respectful. She had learned to stopper the emotions that had gotten her into so much trouble in her 10 years as a Tezuan son disciple. They boiled inside her, but she had become more careful about how often they showed themselves. It allowed her to watch the formal proceedings with just the hint of a smile betraying her intent. One by one, the students 20 years aged were called before Mother Stina, the highest ranked of their temple. One by one, each learned their fate. By their skills and their conduct during their training, each had been evaluated and the masters had figured out how best they would serve the temple. The honored few were taken on as full brothers and sisters of the order. Those would teach and lead as successors of the temple's legacy. Others were assigned as gardeners, cooks, or other servant positions. The temple allowed no outsiders, and certain tasks were better suited for adults to oversee, rather than the young disciples. Those chosen for such roles were rarely surprised, as their later years had groomed them for specific specialities. Another group was sent away from the temple. They would be expected to use their skills to earn money, most of which would be sent back to the temple to pay for their meager needs. It was the only source of income the ascetics had. Soria was impatient. She knew her fate, and 6 years seemed too long to wait. She would never belong in the temple. Juliana's eyes saw more of the world each morning than Soria's had since the temple had taken her in. There was a world beyond the walls, and Varnas had promised to show it to her. He was waiting in Delphar for her, just an hour's walk from the Temple of the Sun. All she had to do was earn her freedom to leave.
"Are there any who would challenge their fate?" Mother Stina asked, after the last of the assignments was handed down.
They were the words Soria was waiting for.
"I challenge my fate," Soria proclaimed,
standing and addressing Mother Stina directly. As far as she could recall, it was the first she had spoken to the mother of the temple, aside from apologies and excuses for her behavior.
"Your fate was not chosen today, young Soria," Mother Stina replied serenely. "That is what I challenge. I want my fate settled,"
Soria countered, and she began to walk forward, picking her way through the neatly ordered rows of her fellow students. She stopped a few paces from the elderly Tejuan ascetic. The two women locked gazes. The younger was clad in nothing but the loose black pants that all the students wore, and the cloth wrap the girls wore about their chests. She was barefooted, bare-armed, but wore a look of determination like armor. The elder wore a robe of silk, the color of saffron, which shone in the early morning light. She wore sandals beneath the robe, and walked with a staff that was a badge of authority more than any sort of aid. Her wrinkled face kept a serene look in place, but her dark eyes betrayed a hint of annoyance. Soria had a rather inimitable ability to annoy Mother Stina.
"Your fate is to spend 6 more years learning humility and patience," Mother Stina spoke coldly,
never taking her eyes from her petitioner.
"I challenge that too," Soria shot back.
There were gasps from among the onlooking disciples, and even a few of the instructors. A few mutters were heard, but Mother Stina's gaze quickly swept the courtyard, and all was silent again, save for the morning calls of the birds.
"So be it. If you would challenge me, then do so," Mother Stina declared.
Soria fought back a grin, gritting her teeth and pursing her lips. Many years, one or more of the disciples challenged the fate they were assigned. Few ever managed to actually oppose Mother Stina. She would stare at them until they changed their minds and yielded, never having so much as taken a fighting stance. Soria had paid closer attention the last year, when Ranmo had objected to being sent out rather than being installed as a fighting instructor, as he had wished. She had seen the rudimentary telekinesis that the old woman used, holding her opponent in place with the power of her san, what the Tezuan called ether or source. They did not understand the two separately. Juliana had spent a good deal of time helping Soria find out how to counter such a trick.
"Do you yield?" Mother Stina asked.
Her manner suggested the mere question was a formality. Soria watched in the ether as the tendrils of Mother Stina's spell wove themselves around her. Soria's source was stronger than Ranmo's had been, and was not held entirely immobile. Fighting the spell, she brought her hands up in front of her, palms facing Mother Stina. With a quick jerk, she spread her hands, severing the spell's connection to her. She continued the motion into a Tejuan fighting stance. Mother Stina seemed the tiniest bit surprised, but accepted that she would have to fight Soria to enforce her edict. The old woman let her go her staff, which balanced perfectly on end, demonstrating her skill and control. Soria saw through that little trick as well. She reached out in the ether and loosed the staff from Mother Stina's spell as well. It clattered to the ground, and Soria could not stop herself any longer. Her lips curled into the mischievous grin that had accompanied so many of the troubles she had gotten herself into during her years at the Temple of the Sun. Mother Stina took the small disrespect for what it was, and leapt to the attack. No follower of the Tejuan Wei was unschooled in combat. Age and experience often triumphed over the strength and speed of youth. The old woman flew through the air with her body outstretched, one foot leading in a kick. Soria ducked the blow and spun to face Mother Stina as the old ascetic landed behind her. Soria slapped aside two punches, a kick, another punch. Mother Stina thought to overwhelm an undisciplined defense. Soria kept her ether in check, her source balanced. She took ether to where it was the most needed within her body, legs to speed her footwork, forearms to absorb impacts, hands to deliver blows. While Soria had started out on defense, she merely wanted to put on a show for the watching throng of disciples and instructors. Her first punch was faster than Mother Stina imagined a disciple could throw. It caught her squarely in the chest and took her from her feet. Mother Stina hit the ground as fluidly as any ascetic among them could manage, landing in a roll and popping back to her feet immediately. Soria could tell the blow had hurt her, though. A few murmurs began again among the disciples, but this time Stina was in no position to silence them. "No, I do not yield," Soria finally answered. Mother Stina was more cautious in her second onslaught, keeping her defenses up while making attack after attack. She tried trips and feints, punches, kicks, and elbows. She tried to grab Soria to throw her. Nothing worked. Soria was too fast, her source speeding her movements by skilled direction of the ether within it. Finally, one blow aimed at Soria's face struck cleanly. Soria had made no attempt to block, dodge, or deflect it. Even with her own sand to strengthen and protect her, Mother Stina broke her hand against the shielding spell Soria enacted. Juliana had learned to cast them two seasons before, and Soria had been practicing them almost non-stop ever since. As Mother Stina recoiled in pain from the unexpected impact against something she had not seen, Soria grabbed the wrist of her broken hand. She pulled down and across her body, bringing Mother Stina's stomach to her own knee and a solid contact. As the old woman doubled over, Soria brought her free hand across and struck a blow to Mother Stina's jaw. The Tejuan mother's control of her sand kept her teeth in her mouth, but a spray of blood and spittle spread across the stone floor. As Soria twisted her arm and forced her to the ground, to all appearances preparing for a fatal blow, Mother Stina spoke up.
"I yield,"
the old ascetic croaked through bloody lips.
"Be gone and never return, you rotten, ungrateful child."
"Thank you. That is all I wanted," Soria replied, letting go the old woman's arm. To the rest of the assembly, she said, "Should I encounter any of you in the world out there, we will be as strangers. There is no past between us. I am starting anew. Friendships I may remember, but I leave all grudges here. Any who seek to do me harm or take my freedom again, remember this," she said, pointing to where Mother Stina lay. That night, she changed into some traveling clothes at the inn where Zelasan was staying. She met his friends, Tanner and Rikashi. They did not care that she was not Keshi-born, like so many of her fellow disciples had. They spoke Juliana's language to her until she relearned the forgotten accordion of her infancy. They treated her like a friend.
"What do you mean, yield? You have not even begun to fight him yet," Parjak objected.
"I yield," Darben whispered hoarsely, short of breath as Soria's spell held his chest tightly. A heartbeat later, he slumped forward, coughing and gasping to cover his breath as Soria released him. She turned her attention back to Parjak. "Satisfied, Darben?" she called out over her shoulder, watching Parjak as she did so.
"Yes, Master, she is Tejuan," Darben confirmed between ragged breaths.
"What nonsense is this?" Parjak demanded. "I ordered you to test her in combat, not stare at her and lose your composure. You ought to be ashamed of yourself."
"Master, it is a Tejuan technique that is beyond me.
My muscles stiffened and I could not move.
Darbin begged his master's forgiveness.
Please, believe me.
Jovin.
Parzhek turned his attention to his other guard.
You fight her then. See if you can actually attack her, unlike cowardly Darbin.
No, master. With respect, I will not.
Jovin answered, bowing slightly in deference despite his insubordination.
Fine. If you will not fight a girl, prove yourself against a large one. This is your test, though, not his. If you will not fight this one, I will dismiss both of you from my service,
Parzhek snarled.
Of course, master. I hope to redeem myself in your eyes,
Jovin replied, obviously relieved to be fighting the giant Zelasan instead of the tall but wispy Soria.
No helmet or blade, but you may wear the rest of your armor,
he told his opponent. Zelasan grunted a reply, handed Tanner his helm and sword, and stepped forward to meet his opponent. He was a full head taller and twice the man's heft, but he had seen Soria fight and was wary of another with her pedigree. He took up a brawler stance, crouched just slightly, chin tucked, hands raised in loose fists with his forearms framing his face. He could tighten his fist to punch, but was ready to grab as well. Grappling seemed likely to favor him, should the chance present itself. Soria and Tanner exchanged looks. By a system they had worked out over years of traveling and gambling together, they settled on a wager without so much as a word or hand signal. Tanner favored the Tejuan fighter for 2,000 decals. Soria gave him 2-to-1 odds in Zell's favor.
Soria had never been able to manage a mind-speaking spell silently,
so they had developed other ways to communicate surreptitiously. They had no real worry about their host and prospective employer learning about their wager, but whoever was found to be betting against Zelasan would find themselves on the wrong side of a very large man's temper should he find out. The two opponents circled, each feeling the other out. Jovin shot quick punches and kicks at Zelasan to test the big man's reaction time. Zelasan threw jabs to find his range and move close enough to hit the smaller man. Zell had little formal training in Tellurak, but had been in many brawls, stretching across decades back to his youth. His Kadrin training included some hand fighting, but he had never kept up with it, seeing as he always had a blade near at hand.
Jovin landed a kick that Zelasan caught on his forearm,
taking it full force to protect his head. His mail coat spread the blow's force and probably kept his forearm from breaking.
He doesn't hit like Soria, though. Must not be able to do that thing with the ether that she says she does.
Jovin tried to follow up with a similar attack, but just fainted as Zelasan hopped back quickly. Zell threw a pair of quick jabs, purposely pulling them short, hoping to confuse his opponent about his reach and draw him a bit closer. Jovin tried the high kick again, but it was another feint. Zelasan predicted it and moved forward instead of back. Both men ended up surprised as Jovin's quick follow-up kick connected with the side of Zelasan's knee, and Zell managed to grab hold of Jovin's upper arm. Zell grunted in pain as his knee nearly buckled beneath him. Jovin let out a quick yelp as the larger man followed up by putting his other hand to Jovin's stomach and lifting him off his feet.
Enough!
Parzhek shouted, just as it looked like Zelasan was going to hurl the Tejuan bodyguard head first to the marble floor like a spear.
You have both satisfied my curiosity. I wish to lose no men before the trap has even been baited.
Zelasan gave the Keshi man a curious look, then shrugged and set him down on his feet.
My apologies if I have injured you, Jovin said.
I've had worse, Zell replied, favoring the leg heavily. Darbin, I give you another chance, Parzhek said to the other Tejuan. You do not get another opponent. You fight, or you find a new master.
It is not worth losing your job over, Soria told him mildly, stepping toward the Keshi she had defeated once already.
Please, forgive me, mistress.
He bowed to Soria and found he was able to take up his fighting posture.
Soria did not mirror it, nor take any stance at all. She merely stood and nodded her readiness to Darben, who approached her cautiously. With the first tentative punch, he was done in. Channeling ether through her muscles, Soria reacted more quickly than any opponent Darben had ever faced. She grabbed him by the wrist and yanked him forward right into a side kick, which Soria buried low in his stomach. The blow was hard enough to lift the man from his feet. He wore hardened leather armor and was trained to tighten his core muscles when hit, but still had the wind knocked out of him. Soria kept hold of his wrist and drew him forward as his legs and lower torso went back, resulting in a cringe from the spectators when he landed spread out flat as he hit the straw mat on the floor. Soria released his wrist, and Darben struggled to his hands and knees, again desperate for breath. "You are hired," Parzhek informed her.